This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks so much, guys. It is a difficult and uncertain time financially for most, this correspondent included, so if you can support this podcast and the Best Evidence newsletter with a paid subscription, Eve Beatty and I would be so grateful. And if you can't, we totally get it. We're just glad that you're reading and listening. And speaking of listening, let's get to the episode proper.
I have a huge trust fund and access to the world's best artists. It would be insane not to put that to good use. I want to do something important, something good.
And what exactly do you want from me?
My guest and I were all set to review Amazon's docuseries The Last Narc for you guys, and then it got disappeared. But we know right where Anna Sorokin is, so we shifted gears to talk about the BBC's podcast about Sorokin and her scam, quote, artistry instead. It's called Fake Heiress, but its music rights clearance budget is for real. We'll talk about that and an unsolved mystery segment about the disappearance of Nylene Marshall that led to another kid getting found, except the show's update segment on that got last narked. Appearances are apparently determined to be deceiving on The Blotter Presents, episode 144. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast in search of the true crime that's worth your time. It's possible my guest has been replaced with Folger's crystals in the time it took me to read that intro, but I really hope not. Please welcome Jessica Lees back to the pod. Right? Hello? Are you there?
I'm here for now. I don't know how much time we've got. I think they are on to us.
I really think they are. A little behind the scenes intel for you listeners. We're recording this like 2.5 hours after we had originally planned to because my soundboard program was just like, so the CIA pulled the series? Nope. And I had to do a factory reset. Good times. But here we are. I hope if you're listening to this, all is well. But if you don't hear from me for a couple of days, maybe alert someone. I don't want to turn into a cold case. I actually wrote a little bit about this on bestevidence.fyi on Monday, as you're listening to this, and the fact that it's the two of us and two other periodicals have mentioned this, and nobody else is saying anything about it.
It's completely insane. It's peak 2020, I think.
Yeah. I think so too. I mean, it's not that there's nothing else going on, but like anything even tangentially related to Tiger King would have been blogged into the stratosphere. This, nobody's talking. And I guess we shouldn't either unless we want to get renditioned in the middle of a sentence. So let's move on to safer topics in our first cold case section of the day. We are talking about Fake Heiress, which is the Anna Delvey / Sorokin podcast from the BBC from the end of 2019, i.e. the before time. Here's the case file. I can't imagine anyone listening actually needs me to review the case of Anna Delvey, so here's the Beeb's take from Fake Heiress's landing page, quote, Anna Delvey was due to come into a trust fund of $67 million on her 26th birthday. She was on her way to establishing the Anna Delvey Foundation, a multi-million-dollar visual arts centre in the heart of New York City. She filled her time with champagne brunches and stays in penthouse suites as she wined and dined the New York elites to secure investment for her project. It all sounded wonderful. Except it was all a lie. Behind Anna Delvey the heiress was Anna Sorokin, the recent magazine intern. Out of nothing, this otherwise unremarkable 20-something had reinvented herself as a multimillionaire socialite, conning businesses and friends out of thousands of dollars in the process. But how? How did she manage to live a life of luxury for so long? How did she make anyone believe her story? How did she get people to trust her enough to give her their money? Journalist Vicky Baker and playwright Chloe Moss dig deeper into the New York scandal and mix drama with documentary to tell the story of Anna Delvey's rise and fall. End quote. Okay. So, overall thoughts?
Well, it's clear that they had a massive budget to put this thing out, was my first thought. It's very slickly produced. It's well done for what it is, but then it's such a weird way to tell this story. And so maybe it's just because we've heard many iterations of this story. There was kind of a moment where we had some kind of Anna Delvey saturation point, and everybody was talking about it, and everybody had kind of the same angle. And this is trying to do something different, but it doesn't really know what that different thing is.
Yeah, I think maybe it. I think maybe it's just not for us. I think
Could
it is
be.
For listeners overseas, like people who are not. I think people in the States probably hit saturation point at this at the end of 2018, and then another story cycle bubbled up with her trial, which I guess was April of 2019. This came out, I believe, November or December of 2019, this podcast. So the ways in which it is sort of trying to, I don't even know, like explicate the scam and also psychoanalyze Anna Delvey is like, we were like a year ahead of this story since we're Americans. So maybe it's just not for us. It's for people who somehow had never heard of this story, even though I feel like it was the Tiger King of 2018.
Well, ironically, those of us who devour true crime podcasts like Oxygen already knew about Tiger King, too, because there was the season of Over My Dead Body that covered all the exact same ground with a little bit more of a pro Carol Baskin bent, but
well,
I digress.
It's hard not to have a more pro Carol Baskin bent than Tiger King.
Very true.
I mean,
very true.
I don't know. That's a moment. That's a discussion for a different episode, I think. You had some notes about, I mean, I agree that the music and the music budget are insane, but you had some notes about how this is one of the least sympathetic accounts of Anna Delvey that you've encountered. And I wanted you to talk about that because I feel like they're all pretty unsympathetic.
Well, in some ways, yes. But in other ways, there's this sort of, when they go to glamorize this tale and tell the story, I think maybe a little bit less in the case of the Rachel Williams Vanity Fair article, but certainly in some of the other products I've consumed around Anna Delvey, there's this kind of excitement around the idea that someone could pull this off. And I think maybe this accounts for the main differences between a BBC product and an American product, because the BBC has zero tolerance for anybody who's looking to get one over on rich guys. And I feel like it's a very American thing to invent yourself from nothing and come in and get one over on the rich guys. And in the UK, they lean heavily on this idea that, you know, they don't really care so much about inventing yourself from nothing. And so many of the other pieces kind of make it seem like it's almost a how-to manual. Like, if you were going to do this, and we're not advocating that you should, but you certainly would want to do this, this, and this, and look at all these cool free things she got. And then, of course, comeuppance came for her, but she got cool free things. And this one is almost, it's almost condescending to her background in a lot of ways. Like, they talk about her scams with this sort of disdain, like, how did she think she could pull this off? And it makes fun of her constantly for having the audacity to not be born into the aristocracy.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, that because this is, I can't claim to understand how class consciousness works in Britain and works on Britons. So like there's some of this that I don't really understand, but I totally agree with you that, well, let me put it another way. I think that at least for me, the pleasure from a story of a a con or a fraud or an identity occupation or whatever, is the how-to. And this, there is this admiration. It's kind of like Prison Breaks, in which no one actually gets hurt, which is none of them. But anyway, that you're kind of like, you know it's wrong and you acknowledge that it's wrong, but there's an aspirational quality to it. And I think we have been asked in our fictional properties to sort of admire or relate to this ever since Gatsby and probably before. So,
oh, for sure.
There's you definitely, want, sorry, go ahead.
You want George Clooney to pull one over on Andy Garcia.
Yeah.
Like Andy Garcia is almost the bad guy. And here, this is kind of saying, well, George Clooney wouldn't be the good guy of the UK produced Ocean's 11.
No, he really wouldn't be. And now I kind of want to see a remake or like a British edit of Ocean's 11 where Andy Garcia is the, you know, beleaguered hero who is responsible for corporate millions being stolen on his watch. What a tragedy. But I think that's really an excellent point. And there are, I think there are issues of class running all through this. And some of them are not correct. I'm going to play a clip in which one of her former colleagues is talking about how she always had all these labels, but then Vicky Baker's like, well, it's not like she mentioned that she had a trust fund. And my first thought with that was like, well, of course she didn't. Like, you don't, like, really rich people, in my experience of having been a little fish at an Ivy League university, like, they dress like hobos. You have no idea. Lachlan Murdoch looked like he had rolled out of bed under a train every day. Which, like, fine. I don't, like, he's not my kid. I don't care. But, like, how is it that you think actual heiresses would be in the context of an internship? Morning, Anna. How's it going? Good. I have a huge trust fund. That's not how it works. Is it? I don't know. I'm not an heiress, fake or otherwise. Anyway, here's clip two.
The 500 Celine sunglasses, the Prada Miu Miu Dior jacket, the Miu Miu dresses. I mean, that's a budget. Mm. Nobody can buy that.
Did she have a lot of that, or did you see the sort of same outfit in rotation?
She was always dressed in black. So when someone is dressed in black, you can never tell.
It's pretty clear that Anna did not arrive in the Purple Office trumpeting family wealth. At least no one I have spoken to remembers Anna mentioning a trust fund in those days. So did the first insinuation slip out as a little white lie, and then she ran with it? Or was this reinvention much more calculated?
It was much more calculated, duh. I mean, I don't know. I think that that's a big part of how this kind of scam works. Is that, like, see also Clark Rockefeller and the many people after the fact who are like, well, rich people never bring their wallets because they're rich and they're stupid about shit like that.
I mean, it's a banana. How much could it cost? $10?
Who was the, was it H.W. Bush who, like, notoriously went grocery shopping and was like, milk is how much? And it's like, dude, how long has it been since you've been in a Wawa market? And he's like, oh, is that where we are? Yikes. So
yeah,
that part of it and how they kept harping on various people in her life, like pointing out these ways in which she was a vulgarian, was extremely odd. Do you mind if I skip ahead to this, to the scrambled egg theory clip that you asked for?
Yeah, please play that clip.
Oh my God. Okay. Here is, not Rachel Deloach Williams, but her other, I guess, scammy, Jesse, who accompanied them on the Morocco trip in clip five.
I asked Jesse if he had any suspicions about Anna not being wealthy.
I just feel she was a bit cliche. I mean, she would order scrambled eggs and order them well cooked, and I just feel like people with good taste wouldn't do that with their food. Like, that's a small example, but she did that everywhere. You know, like, her taste was so cliche, it didn't strike me as someone with worldly experience.
That's a new one to me. I've heard people say that she didn't look like a multimillionaire because she almost always had scruffy hair, but I've never heard the scrambled eggs theory.
Neither have I, because it's not a thing.
Yeah, they spend so much time talking about how hashtag basic she is.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like they're, in a lot of cases, it feels like they're trying to make themselves feel better for getting scammed. It's like, well, you know, I got scammed. At least I didn't get scammed by somebody awesome.
Yeah. Or, I don't know, that in retrospect, they're like, well, it's very obvious that she didn't actually have any money. And it's like, oh, word? Is that why you are being interviewed for this story? Because she didn't get away with it? Okay.
Yeah, I figured it all out eventually because I'm not so stupid that I never would have figured it out.
This is just one of those things. Like, my grandma, who was born Clara Louise Mazzoni in South Philadelphia, and when I knew her as an old lady, would to go visit a friend to, like, sit around eating ice cream on a summer afternoon and watching soap operas, would wear white gloves and a hat. So this is what we call a striver. And it's just funny to me that these, like, Wartonian ideas of how you're supposed to ask for your eggs are just now occurring to these people who had no idea what was happening at the time. And that's part of what I love about this story, not about Anna, who kind of sounds like an asshole, but about the story that now everybody is content to be like, well, steak medium, what a peasant. Like, okay, take it easy.
Yeah, she's not one of us, which is why she had to scam people, I guess.
Yeah. I guess. And, you know, as always, I am struck by how much work. There is a quote about this in the podcast during a reenactment, which I did not clip, but there is some quote where she's like, everything's crashing down around me. I've worked so hard. And it's like, she really did work pretty hard on this scam, on this, like, house of cards. So it always strikes me with these cons, like, why don't you just actually do the work that's legal? Because it... I mean, at least you won't be in jail. So, you know, that there is a lot of work and setup that goes into these things. Look, we all watched Ocean's 11, like you said. These things are a project. I want to play a clip that's talking about Hunter Lee Soik, I think his name is, and his bullshitty vaporware recording your dreams app that I think he might be in hiding. I couldn't actually find anything recent about him, but this was an, I believe, early associate of Anna's as she was beginning to make her entree into New York. And where's the pod about this super douche? Clip 3.
Seriously? No updates in 2 months?
How about an update on this project?
Seriously, it's August now. Where's our Android?
No updates for a year and a half?
So many people have commented they just want an update, not even the app. Their book, t-shirt, or whatever else they're due, but just an update. Can you please just give us that?
To give you some insight into Hunter, instead of all the best or kind regards, he signs off all his emails with the word forward in block capitals with an exclamation mark. This was his brand. He was motivated and driven. When people voiced their concerns over Shadow, he assured them on the crowdfunder website that it was on its way.
I apologize if it feels like I'm ignoring you. I'm on the site every day posting interesting articles and answering private messages.
I mean, I too signed letters with the word onward and an exclamation point when I was 9. Then I turned 10 and stopped doing it. is A. B, interesting articles. You are a horse's ass. Someone please make a pod about the sky immediately. And is it right after this that they do the smash into the OJ's money?
No, the one they smash into here, I think, is I think it's Hypnotize.
Oh, yes.
They go into that
right.
And they're like, and it was just, there are so many egregious music cuts here because they had a budget where they could buy the rights to any song in the Western catalog. And so they didn't bother thinking hard about what music they were going to choose. And so it just ended up being like, we're going to sit in the boardroom for 5 seconds and just write out a list of all the songs we can think of in 5 seconds about money. And also none of us has more than 150 songs on our iPod. And
yeah.
So this is where
you say they searched Apple Music for the word money, yeah. But that's yes. That's way more effort than they actually put into it. You're right.
The OJs was probably the worst exemplar of this. Pretty much, that song has been ruined for everybody forever.
Oh, yeah.
But it gets ruined even harder here, if that's possible.
Yeah, that was definitely a place where I think it was when I heard that music cue that I made the note that was like, I don't think this is for people in the States at all. Because if it were, they wouldn't have triggered us with that Trumpy cue.
Yeah.
But they did. And I don't think that necessarily occurs to them to avoid
I think in the
stuff
UK,
like that.
Maybe they don't know that was a thing over here.
Yeah. I mean, it would be hard at this point not to know that it was a thing, but maybe they're just like, well, but it's a really good song. Like, yeah, it used to be. There's a lot of good Michael Jackson songs too, but you have to live in the world that is. So can we not? This is bad enough.
Yeah.
Your next clip that you called for concerns the dramatical reenactments of what you call the creator's Anna Delvey fanfic. I absolutely don't understand what the actor who plays Anna Delvey in this, whose name is Bella Dane, is going for here. Like, she makes Anna Delvey sound like a real, like, valley turd. Usually, sometimes Chloe Moss, is that right? Sometimes the scripter, like, leaves in these little Euroisms that you're like, that's not it for Americans. And why is everyone in Anna Delvey's house speak it, like, why has she gone back to Russian accented English at her home with her Russian parents? The concept is very odd. Shall we hear a clip and then talk a little bit about how she might have been directed in this part?
I think that's a great idea.
All right. Here is Anya at home watching YouTube videos to teach herself how to send anonymous emails and getting shaded for like the 14th time for not being Lady Delvey.
Court records later showed that around this time, she started falsifying financial documents. It was hardly a sophisticated operation. She used Microsoft Word. Her Google search history also showed that she'd queried things like how to create fake, untraceable emails. I like to imagine Anna doing this upstairs in her parents' house, door shut, like a sulky teenager, watching instructional YouTube videos.
Today, I want to talk you through exactly what an anonymous email is and how it works. Uh-huh. Usually, we never get...
What?
There's strudel on the table.
I'll have it later. I'm busy.
How? So you can start sending your own anonymous emails today.
Like, how dare she live at home with her middle-class parents and not have money already?
I mean, not to mention, what is that Yakov Smirnoff foolishness? I will do it later. I'm busy. I'm just going to start talking to the dog like that. I will whack you later. I'm busy. And then he'll pee on the floor and we'll all learn a lesson about having terrible Russian accents. I don't think that this is incorrect information, but it's interesting that this is considered sort of just as big a crime as the actual crimes. At least in terms of, the host seems particularly struck by her inability to not be where she's from. And that's just as serious as her basically trying to heist 60 grand from a photo editor at Vanity Fair.
Yeah. Well, the most interesting thing, I think, when you read said photo editor's actual account of what happened, which was my entree into the world of Anna Delvey, it takes the other direction. It's kind of, she goes out of her way to mention over and over, I didn't actually have this money and this was not something I could fund, and yet she went after me anyway. And it's almost implying if she had gone after somebody who actually did have a trust fund, that would have been more okay.
Yeah. I think in Sorokin's mind, this was excusable because the real problem with Rachel, I think, is that she ended up putting a lot of this on a corporate card and then having to go hat in hand to her boss, who was pretty cool about it, and say, you know, I got conned on the corporate card. Sorry. But
you know, that's not the first time that's happened.
No, of course not. So I guess that's also supposed to be a victimless crime, except not really. Like, you know, someone ends up paying for this down the line. I mean, there are a lot of ways in which this scam should not have worked. Like, if you're dealing with anyone who has ever done a wire transfer in any direction, it's not going to fly. But, you know, people don't want to believe that that's what's happening. So, you know, that's the foundation of the con, is that you don't want to admit that you were conned. So, but yeah, the voice acting, I don't think she's bad exactly. It's just a very weird, like slushily affected accent, and throughout there are like mysterious choices made about American locutions and pronunciation that are tells. Like that there weren't any Americans who would do this for you. And
yeah, and the British actors they got tend to only know a couple of different American accents.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, our next clip is yet more regretting that that Anna is like, she's not even like a chav. Like, there's nothing for the British to latch onto with this. It's like they sort of don't, there's something that doesn't translate to the British mindset about her. So here's clip six.
Her crimes were not victimless, but people did not necessarily see it that way. Anna certainly provokes mixed feelings, especially from the people who knew her.
I think it's a scary time. I think we're celebrating some extreme narcissists in the world. Maybe out of a frustration with the systems as they are, you know, financial systems or political systems, whatever. But I think I would be wary of latching on to someone who seems ostensibly like an anti-hero in like a very superficial way. I'd say look deeper, look at their motives. The systems that Anna was working to undermine, she wasn't doing it out of some sort of altruistic nobility. She wanted to be a part of them.
Yeah, it's very odd that this question is even being answered. I mean, by which I mean, there's absolutely no way, I don't think, that a North American podcast or property would posit that what Sorokin was doing was fighting the power.
She's not Robin Hood.
No. She's not even Robin. Like, she sucks at Robin, actually.
Yeah. She just skips out on a couple of hotel bills. Basically.
Yeah. I mean, she's not actually that good at it. Like, when you net everything out, she's not actually that good. Like, she, you know, I feel that I have some notes.
But yeah, there's one where they're speaking to one of her scammees who they make note she didn't actually owe him all that much money. It was just $2,000 or $3,000 in the end.
Yeah.
And I can see an American property kind of spinning that out like he's probably not going to miss that. And she had a really great day out of it. But this time it was like, oh, she's not that great at scamming. And also she's vulgar trash.
Yeah. I mean, you have a bunch of issues with this podcast as far as it not being for the American listener, the very obvious non-American Americanness of the accents is A.
Yes.
And there is this weird preoccupation with the part of her scam that was her pretending to be something she wasn't, or above her raisin, as they say in the American South. Whereas this part of it, I don't think, like, that's what cons do. That's the fucking point of them. And Americans would not be offended by her pretending to be rich. It's the taking money that doesn't belong to her part and not paying it back. And the kind of Ponzi check kiting stuff, like, those are crimes. That's why she's in jail. So there's that part of it that I think for this podcast to be kind of relentlessly pointing out, like, well, and also her family doesn't have a castle, that Americans are like, uh-huh. Like, where's your castle, basic? Shut up about this already.
So there's, yeah, the thing is, there's nothing there to replace it, though. Like, they kind of take out the idea that she is a protagonist, and then there is no protagonist. There's nobody that you want to kind of win the day.
Yeah.
It's like everybody they speak about and to is completely awful.
Yeah.
And
kind of
when you, I think the difference is, in just about every true crime property, somebody is there that we want to win, whether it's a victim needs to achieve justice or law enforcement needs to catch the criminal, or the bad guy has some good points and needs to get away with it. And we don't really have any of that. It's just like, here is a person we don't like very much who did a bad thing to some other people we don't like.
Yeah. And law enforcement plays such a relatively small role in this story and kind of comes into it so late in the narrative that you can't really root for them either. And then especially once Pippa, whoever, who is trying on some Brooklyn for the day, tries on some Brooklyn for the day. It doesn't go well. And here's the irony, is that this podcast as a production is so extra that it's asking for its scrambled eggs to be cooked well in terms of the production values. Like, it's just so splashy. It's like that, you know, kid in your class who, like, oh, well, they're the ones who have a, like, dollar bill phone booth thing at their sweet 16. Like, oh, it's them. Like, it's the audio production equivalent of that, and yet they spend all this time harping on class issues and how Sorokin didn't, like, know the true meaning of aristocracy, and she would wear all these labels, but she was a big fake. And it's like, well, but you're also kind of a big fake, because at the heart of this story is no heart.
Yeah, there's no there.
Yeah. With all of that said, this was quite an entertaining listen. Like, it's not good, but it's not bad. I mean, it's bad, but it's like really listenably bad. It's like British Pringles. It's not good for you. The way it's made is weird. Like, why is this compressed powdered potato in my face hole? But you can't, you kind of can't stop eating them. That was my experience anyway. I listened to the whole thing.
Yeah, as did I. And it's entertaining and it's very well produced. And I like the idea of mixing this kind of reported narration with reenactments, which we'll get into where the roots of that lie in our next segment. but it's a great idea of how to present a story like this. I just don't know that this was the story that we needed to have told like this from these people from this angle.
Well, now that we mention it, I kind of want this to be an ongoing series in which we hand them like a short list of notorious cons and frauds to do with identity theft and sort of class shifting that we don't think of that way, but that the British, with their sort of different class radar, would have a different take on, and then just see what they do with it. Like, okay, James Hogue, what you got? And they'll be like, oh, the upper echelons of the Ivy League institutions. And it'd be like, oh, is that what you're getting out of it? Interesting, because he's mentally ill. But that's, I don't think they're going to sort of seize on the compulsion part of it. They'll be like, well, he, you know, what a tiresome striver. And okay, yes, that also, but is that the, is, should that be the focus of everything? So, but there's also this like bingo card quality of extra-ness to it that it's like, all right, which money related music cue is going to be next? Which word with an R at the end is going to be mangled now? It really is fun. And each episode, I think the longest one is like 37 minutes. You just like blow through it while working on a craft in an afternoon and you're done. It's six episodes. So yeah, I mean, it, like I said, it's extremely well-made and expensive garbage. And I guess I recommend it.
Yeah, recommend it, question mark.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's where it is.
It really depends on how interested you are in the topic and how much else is on your plate.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I generally speaking with stuff like this, I allow myself and allow guests to just stop after one or two if you get the gist. And I could have stopped. It's not like I don't know what happened, but I was like, all right, let's just see where this goes. Like, let's see how they do the Morocco trip. And then you're almost at the end. It's like, oh, let's finish this up. But before we end our magical class mystery tour, back to the summer of 2018, let's hear one more clip about the production's imagining of Anna's time
yes,
at Rikers. Clip 7.
It's not caviar, hey?
No, it's not caviar.
That what you eat normally?
No.
Caviar and what? What else do princesses eat? I just asked you a question.
And I just ignored you.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Let me give you some advice. When I ask you a question, you answer me.
Let me give you some advice.
Go screw yourself.
It's not caviar. Hey? No, England.
I guess I was unaware that Rikers Island was located in West Virginia.
I would have gone with Jersey, like the original Jersey, not the new one. Because that's not caviar, yes. Hey? where are we? Is Rikers a Channel Island? What's happening?
Wow.
Yeah. That was kind of fun for me that it's like, and there's the Britishism, like, and then you daub it on your bingo card and then you go back to your knitting. At least that's how I spent the time. So yeah. The Music Budget of Champions is available on the BBC's website and wherever you get podcasts. We'll have a link in the show notes. Moving on in our cold case adventures. Normally, I'd play the cold case theme again, but since I went to the trouble of cutting all the Unsolved Mysteries themes into little pieces some time ago, how about this?
Oh, geez.
For every mystery, there is someone somewhere who knows the truth. Perhaps it's you.
I actually do think it's us in this case, but we'll get into it. This season of Unsolved Mysteries that also brought us my husband in skin-tight dungarees and a giant belt buckle yelling at a meth kingpin to get his hands on the hood of the car. Season 3 also brought us episode 10, which was about, among other things, the Nylene Marshall case. Here's the case file from the Unsolved Mysteries fandom wiki, Boulder of Salt. Quote, on June 25th, 1983, 4-year-old Nylene Marshall vanished while on a trip with her mother and stepfather to the Elkhorn Mountains. That day, the Marshalls and several other families traveled to a picnic area in the Helena National Forest. At around 4 p.m., she and several other children went playing along the banks of a shallow creek. Some of them noticed her talking to an unidentified man in a purple jogging suit. He tried to get her to play the game Follow the Shadow. He was the last person to be seen with her before she vanished. For 10 days, searchers combed the area where she was last seen. However, there was no evidence found to determine what happened to her. On November 27, 1985, Nick Mick received an anonymous call from a man who claimed that he had Nylene. 2 months later, an organization called Child Find of America received a typewritten letter from the same man. We'll get into it. He claimed that he was raising her as his own child and that he now calls her Kay. He also claimed that he loved her and did not plan on returning her to her family. Although he claims that he was taking care of her, he also mentioned committing acts that are considered child sexual abuse. We'll get into that too. To date, no trace of Nylene or her abductor has been found, end quote. But, thickening plot. This episode of Unsolved Mysteries led to a tip that reunited another missing child, Monica Bonilla, with her family. Also from the UM Wiki, quote, school officials from Vancouver, British Columbia were watching the November 21st, 1990 episode about Nylene Marshall and believed that one of their students was the missing child. Investigators did background checks on the girl, Marianne Kelly, and her father, Robert Kelly. She was not Nylene. However, it was determined that she was in fact Monica and her father was Guillermo, end quote, who had become increasingly unstable before kidnapping his own daughter 8 years prior. The plot thickens even further as all sources indicate that this follow-up aired in Unsolved Mysteries' third season as well in the February 6, 1991 episode, but I rewatched that entire episode and the segment just is not present, and I can't find it. I watched a bunch of update segments from other season 3 episodes. I even looked in season 4. It's just gone. And on top of that, listeners found my husband after I had spent 6 years combing these episodes for him, so maybe you guys can find this update segment, but Nylene's mother died tragically in Mexico years later. What is this? What is the universe trying to tell us? Jess is my question. Well, I have a bunch of questions.
That's not even cracking the top 10.
No, it's really not. I feel like it's probably pretty clear what happened to Nylene Marshall, but do you want to talk a little bit about your experience with / awareness of this case as a kid?
Well, the amazing thing was I remembered this segment extremely vividly because coming from Montana, it was a big deal whenever national news or quote unquote news mentioned your home state at all. Not to mention, Unsolved Mysteries was my favorite show at the time.
Uh-huh.
I was 10, 10 years old, totally obsessed with it. And then they show this case from Montana, which had been all over the news several years prior. And Nyleen is close in age to me. I think she's a year older than I am. And there was this case, and there was one other case in 1988 that they were basically, you've talked a lot, Sarah, about Eitan Peetz being a formative case of your childhood. And
yes,
I think Nyleen Marshall and the 1988 Delana Clark murder were those for me in Montana in the 80s.
So did you have any sort of sense memories of having seen the segment and like what you thought of it at the time as a kid?
I definitely do, because I think as a kid, you see these missing child segments and you just, I think it's probably true of adults too, but you just want the kid to be safe and okay somewhere. And she's just going to turn up like nothing happened. And then some part of you knows that's really not something that could happen. But I remember very clearly Unsolved Mysteries showing those typewritten letters on the screen. And me being 10 years old, probably having learned what semen even was 2 weeks prior, seeing that and thinking, huh, that's weird that they would even show that to us and then never mention it clearly in the segment. And also, that's super creepy. And it was kind of, it really stuck out at me for years and years. I remembered, I didn't even after I forgot the name of the actual child in the case, I remembered that Unsolved Mysteries segment where this little Montana girl disappears and then some guy sends a typewritten letter about his semen.
Yeah.
And we're supposed to connect the two.
And also that he was, okay, the obvious trigger warning here. You may want to skip ahead like a minute.
Yes.
What he was doing with it was so, I mean, it was still disgusting and horrible and a felony, but it was also extremely bizarre. Like, you don't see that whole paragraph, which raises the question, why didn't you just crop that screen tighter so that we only saw the paragraph where he's like, you know, we love each other and we're a family and I'm not giving her back. And we don't see the word semen at all. But he apparently was putting it in a teaspoon and giving it to her that way as medicine. And she didn't know what it was the impression that I got. I did a screen grab and you'll be able to see that on our social media. That's at Blotter Presents. I apologize for that. But this, in many ways, given the subject matter of this show and how frequently it was like pretty horrible crimes that were happening to kids, they still had to be quite circumspect. Like, it's, you know, the late 80s, the early 90s were very different about what you could say and how you could be about this stuff on TV. So I'm surprised they showed it at all. And then they're extremely euphemistic about it in the Talking Head interview. So, but
yeah.
On the other hand, this guy never had Nyleen Marshall, in my opinion. So.
No, he did not. The only thing I can think of that would account for why they didn't crop that part out, apart from, you know, they wanted the shapes to be the same on the screen or something bullshitty like that. The only other thing I can think of is the rest of the letter as we see it implies that she's thriving and doing great. And I wonder if they kept that in to underline that if this is what happened to her, it's pretty bad and we want to rectify it. And so, you know, terrible things are happening to her and we want to make sure that people aren't watching it and like, oh, well, I'm glad she's okay if that's what happened to her.
Well, right. You know, like, why uproot her? Eesh. I mean, the she whole
probably doesn't even remember.
Yeah. Which, I mean, may be true, but it's not. Not really the point, but the focus of the segment is definitely on sort of clinging to the idea that this letter writer is legit. And even if he doesn't have her know where she is, he might lead to someone who does. As you hear, Robert Stack, may he rest, makes sure to remind people to watch carefully in case they know some relevant info in clip 8.
Nyleen's story is all too familiar. Every year, thousands of children in the United States disappear, and tragically, many of them are never found. With your help, Nyleen's case may have a different ending. 2.5 years after she disappeared, authorities received this letter from an anonymous man who claims he has Nyleen. He writes, "She's a sweet little girl. I realize how much her family must miss her. I love her and I have her. I just can't let her go. Please watch carefully. You may know the man who wrote this letter. You may even know Nyleen K. Marshall."
You don't. Before we get into, I think it's maybe more widespread naivete about how relevant letters like this and sort of law enforcement, unprompted law enforcement contact from self-proclaimed kidnappers was 30 years ago. I want to ask you about what the sort of Montana probability assumption was, for lack of a better phrase. If a kid went missing when you were a kid, was the assumption more tilted towards wandered off and was bested by nature than it would have been in suburban New Jersey, where like it's just a giant wad of towns and it's actually pretty hard to get lost? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think this area specifically, I think that would have been the first assumption. I think it's really on East Coast versus Montana it's kind of hard to envision what this is like. The definition of what constitutes remote and what constitutes crowded and not crowded are kind of very different things. So yeah,
yes, they are.
To say the very least. But this area, I don't even know if the road to get there was paved at the time.
Right.
I kind of think it wasn't. This is in the middle of a giant state park, and it would have been very easy to kind of wander off the trail and lose your way. And the grass around there is pretty tall, to the point where even if you had search parties combing the area, they might not see everything. So I think it is probably the first assumption would be that she wandered off. And that would have been, that's probably my best guess about what actually happened to her.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there is a tendency, at least sort of growing up around here and living around here, to be like, you know, well, they saw a guy in a jogging suit. It's got to be the guy. Like, well, or, you know, she's four. They wander off. They follow butterflies. I could still do that. I'm 47. Like, and, you know, then I was thinking, well, but the dogs didn't find anything. So, you know, if she is dead, did she die out there? And then it's like, well, they were right next to a creek. And that can mean a lot of things. That can mean a little ribbon of water. That can mean it's over a grown-up's head. I think she probably wandered off and slipped. And that's that. I mean, it's a completely different country, basically, out there from here, where you have to work at it to go missing in New Jersey. It's really hard, even for a little kid. So, yeah, I just don't think it was probably foul play. But if it was, the show's commitment to believing that there is still someone to find is, to me, kind of pitiably heartbreaking. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it makes it a lot sadder than it would be otherwise. And I mean, it's already sad if that's all that happened, but I think there's just a tendency to want to believe that there's more to it, that, you know, with no trace of anything that even hints at what might have happened to her, I think there's this tendency to want to think the best possible outcome for her. And they really lean hard into that. And
yeah,
it's an unsolved mysteries thing where they kind of, they will take a hint of a tiny detail and they'll blow it out like it was the thing that actually happened. And I can't find a formal citation of this, but there's a lot of discussion. I clicked around on various Reddit threads about this case.
Oh, dear.
There's Yeah, which is never a rabbit hole that's fun to go down, and especially when you're thinking about the case of a missing child. Yeah, it's creepy, but there's some speculation that the composite sketch of the man in the jogging suit was gleaned by hypnotizing people, which wouldn't have been admissible. And they kind of present it like, and there was definitely a man in a jogging suit that came by, and he's definitely the one who took her. And that's probably not true. That it may or may not be true that he was even there. It's hard to tell. And I think they kind of play it up for dramatic effect, because that if he took her and kept her and took care of her and she was okay, apart from taking some really weird medicine, that's the best possible outcome. And you don't really want to think about the other things.
Yeah. Well, and we've seen in the intervening years that that is not that's not an impossible outcome. We have seen some girls taken and kept, and not that that's a, you know, agreeable circumstance, obviously, but
it wasn't fun for them.
No, but
they did turn up alive.
But when you think about sort of what we as a culture were still ignorant of, and which Unsolved Mysteries was happy, I guess, to either remain ignorant of or let us remain ignorant of, in terms of like, how much can a child really tell you about what they saw? Like, where, you know, on the border of the veil between what a child wants to have happened and what actually happened? Like, where are we? How old were these children exactly? And there's also the fact that they put up these sketches and it's like, have you seen either of these people? And it's like the sketch, particularly of the woman involved in this apparent child napping ring in the American West, looks like the sketch of the woman who Jeffrey McDonald claimed was in his home chanting "Acid is groovy, kill the pigs." Like, there's only ever one identikit lady with long hair. It's all the same lady. So that's not helpful. It just feels like that it's from another time. And this hope that her demise probably did not take place immediately after she wandered off it's sad. And it just makes everything that, you know, like this whole family, like going back on TV, like, well, maybe you saw her, maybe you saw these people, like it's disappearingly small chances. But that was Unsolved Mystery stock and trade, was like finally cracking these cases. So you can't fault them for it. It's just like, it is watching it's watching something from another time.
Yeah. I mean, on the other hand, there were cases on Unsolved Mysteries that had way less to go on that ended up getting solved. So I see why these would be the people you'd go to.
Yeah. And I mean, look, it did get results with this segment that they just didn't find that kid, but they found another kid. So,
I mean, that's
not that we can prove it with a clip. Here's a clip talking about something from a different time. In clip 9, you can hear this law enforcement guy taking as wide a route around what the letter actually says is happening as he possibly can and still be speaking English. Clip 9.
This man said he was taking good care of her. But during the same phone conversation or same letter that he would write, would also make reference to things that he was having Eileen do, which would be sexual abuse.
Yeah. I mean, it's just abuse, period. Like, ooh. And yeah. I'll also note that it's, you know, they would keep rebooting this show with various new hosts, and I didn't mind the Farina version, mostly because it cribbed so heavily from the original. But part of this show was that it was old and that it introduced you to these like ghost stories or these reunions between like 2 5-year-olds who had their tonsils out at the next time and then, or at the same time, and then one of them in the next bed saw the other one get kidnapped and then they're reunited. I mean, I loved it for what it was, but there was one clip at the end of this segment that made me think that they could reboot this for the Reddit era, because they packaged the information for people in such a way that it would be perfect for Google searches, but Google didn't exist yet. So that's our last clip, clip 10.
He states that he now calls Nylene by her middle name, Kay. In his letters, he mentions that his parents and younger sister were killed in a car accident when his sister was 9 years old.
I mean, you don't have to do this anymore, but I can absolutely see the kind of retiree that watched this show, i.e., once again, my grandmother comes up, going down to the Bryn Mawr Library and like looking at the microfiche, like, oh, car crashes in Madison, Wisconsin at X year. Like, someone would track it down. If that happened, someone would track this guy down. He would not have Nylene Marshall, and he would have no idea what year it actually was. But I do wonder if there's a way to, if there's a way to reboot Unsolved Mysteries. And the, you know, the website has never stopped. Unsolved.com just keeps rolling along like the tides. But I wonder if there's a way to make it internet fresh, or maybe just, maybe Reddit just does that and we don't need the show. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, Reddit has a couple of forums. And there's also, I don't know if you have spent any great amount of time listening to Robin Warder's The Trail Went Cold. He does this a lot. He pulls information out of the sitcoms online forums about Unsolved Mysteries. And a lot of his cases that he covers there come from directly from episodes of Unsolved Mysteries. And so I think there is a really robust online community of people who are still obsessed with this kind of thing. There's that, and there's also the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit.
Oh, sure.
And people do that kind of digging. And I feel like, to your point, I think there really needs to be a show that caters directly to these people and kind of surfaces cases that they could be looking into. But they also do a pretty good job of finding these things on their own.
Yeah. And there's also, I feel like various regions and municipalities all have their own preoccupations. Like, this might have been one of yours, and then there was a young woman who died shortly before I was born, like within sight of my parents' house, in this little like piece of municipal land that was really rocky and jagged, and it was called the Devil's Teeth, and that sort of folded into the sad B-roll of satanic panic that we had in my part of New Jersey after that. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you put a subreddit on Jeanette DePalma, you could probably finally figure out what happened. But I also think that a show that is a sort of more general audience and creates a communal feeling around it and is less splintery, I'd watch it every time they try to redo it. And in search of, I'm like, well, I'll try it. I'll always give you a couple hours and see how badly you screw it up. But I ended up watching the whole episode that this was in, even the dumb staircase segment, like
The mystery guardian angel who built the beautiful staircase.
Yeah, that I was like, oh, really? Like, nuns in the desert? And then I was like doing something else and wasn't skipping ahead. And then I was like, oh, there's no structural supports? Huh. And then I'm like making little notes. It was, for what it was a good show. And, you know, now that we live in the streaming era, whenever it's like, this tavern is haunted, you're like, it isn't. Next. Like, you could just skip over it. It's pretty great.
Well, it's one of the things I really love. And, you know, for all the quibbles I have about the way that they handle it, there's a podcast called Resolved, and they are doing a full series rewatch of the Robert Stack Unsolved Mysteries. And It's three women that each take a segment, and then they break down the segment of the episode, and they talk about, they talk around every piece of information they could find that resolves it or not. And the best segments are the ones where they get something really wacky like that. And then they have to point out that, oh, well, this woman who came on who was allegedly a psychic shows up under a different name on another episode and is very clearly not an actual psychic. And it's fascinating. They dig a little too hard, if you ask me, that there's a lot of, I looked for this person on Facebook and I found them on their social media. And that's a little bit, And they also have this tone that they're trying to be a little too My Favorite Murdery about the whole thing. But the raw material of it all is just excellent. And I'm looking forward. They're at mid-season two right now. So this case is going to be coming up in the next 6 months. And I'm very curious as to how they're going to tackle it and what they will do right and wrong there.
I might have to tag in just to see what they'd say about the actually solved mystery of the meth dealer that my husband's character went undercover to find.
Good times. I think you definitely have to.
But yeah, maybe we should circle back and talk about this again in... So they do an episode a week, roughly?
Roughly an episode a week, yeah.
All right, well, let's mark our calendars for Thanksgiving time.
And that gives you enough time to go back into Unsolved Mysteries and pull the sound clip where Robert Stack says, update.
Update. I actually do have the update music. So I am
excellent.
I am prepared. I am absolutely prepared. Well, thank you for soldiering on, as it were, with this podcast, even with repeated topic changes, tech problems, the restless ghost of George Tenet looming over us all. We did it.
Oh man. I mean, it's 2020. This is a peak 2020 podcasting.
It really is. But bless us all. Before you leave us.
In local news today, bees.
Where else can listeners find you?
Right now, you can find me over on postshowrecaps.com, where Josh Wigler and I are covering Killing Eve. Every week, we break down what happened in the episode and share our favorite theories about it. And I'm occasionally contributing feature articles over on primetimer.com. Most recently, I wrote about the new interactive special about Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, speaking of weird kidnappings.
Very good. How are you, in like 15 words, how are you feeling about this season of Killing Eve?
I think I thought for a second they were playing fourth dimensional chess with us and that all of these weird questions I had that spoke to deficiencies in the storytelling, I thought they would resolve them. And I think there's not enough time to resolve them. So I think it might just be sloppy.
Yeah, I think it is. I think you're right. I just quit the show. After the most recent episode, I was like, I want so badly for them to bring it back around, and I don't, like you, I don't think they can. And it seems like folly to quit a TV show when we're going to run out of scripted shit in like 12 minutes, but I can only be who I am. All right, well, thank you again for coming back, and hopefully we will talk to you sooner than when this resolved podcast.
Yes, resolved.
Resolved. All right, I've got some catching up to do, apparently. Coming up on The Blotter Presents. We are off next week for Memorial Day, but Best Evidence will be chugging along, wrapping up True Crime A to Z and bringing you the latest related headlines. After that, Margaret Howie is going to join the podcast for the first time to talk about Quiz, and then Dr. Marcia Chatelain is back to talk about what I keep calling Dirty Betty. It's not Dirty John, Ugly Betty either. That's the other thing I keep calling it. Dirty John, the Betty Broderick story. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and the Gram, and in that Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. Paid subscribers get extra reviews and Blotter briefs, teehee briefs, so sign up today. My guest has been Jessica Lees, and she's on Twitter at HaymakerHattie. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.